Now for agribusiness news, markets, and weather from Studio C, this is Agriculture Today.
You know, there are a few examples, certainly as we see more and more demand, primarily from our cities and urban centers for water. We are seeing, certainly in Texas and California, in North Texas, there was recently a reservoir that was permitted and is being built called Lower Bodark, which is about 13,000 surface acres. That's probably the largest reservoir of its kind being built in the United States at this point.
It's important to take care of the water we do get. Earl Lewis is chief engineer, Western States Water Council.
That had to be done by the local water supply district. The federal government and most of the state governments are not really in the business of building storage and managing that type of infrastructure at this point.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
In 1935, after surveying the aftermath of the worst dust storm ever recorded in North America, Robert Geiger was an Associated Press reporter from Washington, D.C. He summed up the life in our region with three little words achingly familiar on a Western farmer's tongue. If it rains. If it rains.
Dr. Roger Marshall is a member of the Senate Ag Committee from Kansas. On a recent subcommittee hearing on the Western water crisis, the chairman of that subcommittee from Colorado, Michael Bennett.
Our purpose this morning is simple, to sound the alarm about the water crisis in the American West. The West has not been this dry in 1,200 years. 1,200 years. And if we don't get our act together here, it's going to not only put our Western agriculture at risk, but the American West as we know it.
And just how serious is the issue?
This is a five-alarm fire in the American West. When hurricanes and other natural disasters strike the East Coast or the Gulf states, Washington springs into action to protect those communities. That's what a federal government is supposed to do, to bring the full power and resources of the American people together to help our fellow citizens. But we haven't seen anything like that kind of response to the Western water crisis, even though its consequences, I would argue, are far more wide-reaching and sustained than any other natural disaster.
Dr. Marshall says it's time.
It's been almost a decade since drought was a key focus on the Ag Committee hearing, and I'm hoping we can gain some real insight today on how to address the challenges we're facing out west with regards to drought, wildfires, and conservation. Senator Bennett, the western third of Kansas, the eastern third of Colorado look a lot alike these days, and they always have. And you mentioned the Colorado River, but the Arkansas River is very important to us. Now, the Arkansas River is spelled like Arkansas, but we pronounce it Arkansas River as it goes out of Colorado through Kansas. I'm not sure what the Okies call it. Arkansas. They call it Arkansas. I thought they might. But I've enjoyed fly fishing in the headwaters of the Arkansas River. The mayfly hatchery up there is incredible, but much of the riverbed is dry.
Tom Willis is a farmer from southwestern Kansas.
Flexibility is the key to it, maybe shorter-term type programs. The key to getting, in my opinion, in production agriculture is to be able to incentivize the producer to try new technologies without feeling like he's going to lose his farm if things don't work. Because we're an aging population in production agriculture. And so that willingness to step out of the box and say, hey, I want to switch the way that I'm doing things. That's hard. That can be a very hard decision, especially, again, with overall farm income, net farm income projected to be down. So what would I do with them? I think I would mirror a little bit like we do in Kansas, where we say, hey, I go to them. I'd like to put in some probes. I'd like to do this. There's some incentives for me to try that. But then they don't tell me what I have to do from there. They look at the results. I tell them what I want to do. In my case, I said I will reduce my water usage by 50%.
Okay.
And we were able to do that, and we were able to hold net income at the same level.
At the end of the day, farmers need partners, not police.
In today's margins, farm margins with input costs where they are, it's hard to get a farmer to think outside what has worked for him because he doesn't want to lose his farm. So incentivizing that change would be good.
It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
Conditions were mostly favorable for Midwestern planting efforts. For the first time this year, we have seen the corn planting progress passing the five-year average, now 94% of the intended acreage planted by June 5th. That exceeds the five-year average of 92%, where 78% emerged. Five-year average is 81%.
And what are crop conditions? Brad Rippey with USDA says,
we're starting off at 73% good to excellent, and just 4% of the crop rated very poor to poor. I think that we'll continue to see a lot of those Midwestern numbers looking pretty good the next few weeks.
Sentiment echoed by Dan O'Brien, Kansas State grain economist.
Over the top 18 states for corn production, the last five-year average we would be about on this date about 87% planted, and 86 is where we were at in 2022 on May the 29th, and that was a few days ago. So when you look at corn emergence, we're trailing a little bit more with that, 68%. Emerged as five-year average, and we're at 61. Really, the states we're most concerned about would be, well, North Dakota, basically, and North Dakota, Minnesota, South Dakota. And corn plantings in North Dakota, normally 83% done, projected on May the 29th at 56, and emergence at 7%, and 42 would be the five-year average. So still concerns up in that part of the world and in some of those adjacent states. South Dakota trailing a little bit, Minnesota trailing some, about 30%. So that's an issue. I didn't mention for wheat that we have grave concerns about planting of the spring wheat crop up in there. And so here in the hard red area, you look at the soil condition, crop prospects for hard red winter wheat out of Texas, Oklahoma, and Kansas, and then look up to the Dakotas for hard red spring wheat and white wheat right next door, heading into Montana and such. This would have been such a tremendous year to have great production, but we're just struggling in a lot of these major areas. But back on corn, we've had some pretty healthy exports, and apparently ethanol use is holding up pretty well. So the demand side, doing well. Apparently ethanol, with encouragement from EPA and loosening of regulations, et cetera, as I understand them anyway, you know, we're declining in stocks, and I think the U.S. economy, the U.S. government, probably anxious to have ethanol come in and take the top off of where gasoline prices could go. And by the way, out in western Kansas, we're well past $4 now and heading for $4.50 in terms of gas prices. So ethanol is in position to help that out in terms of having additional motor fuel supplies in the market, and that's one factor, frankly, supporting these strong corn prices at elevators. Lowest price at the places we watch, $7.15 in Salinas, $7.30 in Columbus, and that's down about $1.50 or more from the highs that we've had just a bit ago. Mm-hmm. I would say here we're coming into June, planting has happened. Seasonally, are we looking at the type of a situation we've seen in the past where we have strong corn prices on the new crop side, or during this period when we question how the crop's going to get in, or whether we'll successfully get planted? And then is the market assuming that, well, it's going to be planted, we're going to have a great crop, et cetera? Well, we could be seeing some of that also. That said, still they have crop problems in Brazil, and you can see that in our exports. So even though we've had this decline, it sure seems that we have a lot of uncertainty to wrestle with from June through July and August before we declare that, hey, we're moving a whole lot lower into the harvest time.
It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
In the case of ethanol, you've got a product that is about $1 a gallon or more than that, cheaper than gasoline today. You've got gasoline selling at the wholesale level today for $4.20 a gallon. You've got ethanol selling for about $2.80 a gallon. So a $1.40 discount is what we saw in the Chicago market yesterday.
Jeff Cooper, president and CEO of the Renewable Fuels Association.
So obviously, if you're blending more of that lower cost product, it's going to have a favorable impact on lowering prices for consumers at the pump. And that's a direct result of the RFS and these robust requirements for conventional renewable fuels.
Not everything great for the Renewable Fuels Association. Cooper says reopening the 2020 RVOs.
First of all, it sets a troubling precedent. EPA has always said, and they've said this numerous times in the past, that they do not have the authority to go back in time and reopen annual RVO rules once those rules have been finalized. And EPA published a final rule for 2020 all the way back in December of 2019. So the marketplace looked at that final rule and understood it to be the final word on 2020 blending requirements and made plans and made investments. And so for EPA to come back now and retroactively lower those volumes, we think sends a bad signal and potentially sets a bad precedent. And it was unnecessary to begin with, because I think as most folks know, the RFS already has a built-in mechanism for adjusting higher or lower when you've got, significant changes in gasoline and diesel consumption, like we did in 2020 when COVID came around and we had the economy locked down for a couple of months or more. The RVO for 2020 had already adjusted or would have already adjusted lower just based on changes in gasoline and diesel consumption. Our view is EPA should have just let that adjustment work the way it does, and no further meddling with the 2020 RVO would have been needed.
But what about that $700 million of COVID-19 funds USDA just released?
The message there is, better late than never. And the industry is very appreciative of that emergency relief funding finally coming through. We know USDA has been working hard to get that money dispersed. It is. I mean, it's 2 years after the fact. It was about, 2 years ago, 2.5 years ago, when our industry was really clobbered by COVID and the effect of the lockdowns. We had more than half of the industry shut down at one point. More than 150 plants were either completely shut down or had idled back significantly. And we all remember just the devastating financial losses that the industry incurred at that point. So this $700 million that was dispersed today is not going to fully offset those losses, which were in the billions of dollars for the industry in 2020. But it will certainly help soften the blow. And believe it or not, 2 years later, the industry is still recovering from the losses and the difficulties experienced during COVID. And it's been hard for a lot of producers in the industry to get back on their feet. So this assistance will certainly be welcomed. It will be helpful. It will help offset some of those losses that these producers have been carrying on their balance sheets for a while. And so we are appreciative of that and happy to see that program finally being implemented.
It's Agriculture Today.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
First and foremost, we're glad to finally have standards in place for 2021 and 2022.
Jeff Cooper is president and CEO of the Renewable Fuels Association, reacting to EPA's recent announcement of renewable volume obligations under the renewable fuel standard.
We're not big fans of what EPA did on 2020, but overall, this is a good package for the ethanol industry. We do think it brings some order. It brings some stability back to the RFS program, and it really sets up a solid foundation for future growth in the industry and really clears the air on certain issues like small refinery exemptions and other key aspects of the RFS program. So overall, we think a very strong package from EPA today and favorable for the renewable fuels industry.
Obviously, when we talk about ethanol, we're talking about energy. And speaking of energy, Bob Maurer with Manduca Trading in Chicago talks about the volatility.
So it looks right now, as you can look on the charts, you see a big move to the upside and then you see pullbacks, but these pullbacks aren't sustained. There's always some news event that seems to come around and just help those who are looking for some kind of correction to buy, to give them the resolve to go in there and do it. And then we push into new highs. So natty gas definitely being one of them. It rallied from about the 500 level up to the 800 level, broke down to about 65. Then it made a new swing high, came back a little bit, made another swing high, came back a little bit just about a week ago. And here we are today, basically threatening to take out the high from 2 weeks ago. And I can't see a reason why it wouldn't do it. So the demand is there. Plenty of the supply side parts of the equation in terms of the balance sheet are just unknowns right now. And that's just helping these markets rally. Also, from a consumer's perspective, it doesn't seem like the gas prices, eventually they will, but they don't seem like they've had a big enough impact on the decision-making process for those who want to fill up their tanks and do some recreational driving. So it's not like people are pulling back or they're hopping back onto public transportation because that isn't deemed for many a safe option, regardless of where you are in the spectrum with COVID. But, you know, I've been on several trains going in and out of the city at various parts of the day over the last month or so, some on the weekend, some during the day. Normally, it was high percentages that I was going to be on a pretty full train going down into the city or coming back from the city during rush hour, and now it's just not the case. So those who had been using public transportation aren't quite back yet, at least not all of them, right? So we've got that working through in the marketplace. We've got the demand for the summertime in terms of those who want to fill up their tanks and go do some recreational driving, get out of town, do vacations, and it just doesn't seem like the prices have really scared anybody away. Interesting personal anecdote. A couple months ago, over spring break, took my family to California, and I thought at that time, $5.50, almost $6 a gallon seemed like a lot of money for a gallon of gas. When back here in Chicago, it was still only $3.50, $3.75, something like that. And now here in Chicago, it's that $5.50, and Californians are looking for something. Geez, it almost seems like almost close to $10. So it's just crazy what we're seeing in these markets right now. And when I say crazy, it's with parentheses around it, because a lot of things are a little bit off the rails, shall we say, in terms of what's the normal tendencies in these markets. But, you know, we'll just have to see how this plays out. But it certainly seems like the bulls are in charge for the moment until some of the supply side unknowns really work themselves out. And that's just a matter of time.
It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
Recently, the Congressional Budget Office released their estimates of farm program payments, including within that is long-run estimates of prices.
Dr. Gary Schnittke is a University of Illinois ag economist.
They had those prices going back to $4 for corn, $10 for soybeans, and below $5.50 for wheat. Commodity prices tend to have long periods where they do not trend up or down. For example, between 1973 and 2005, corn price averaged $2.36. It did not go up. It did not go down. It varied around that trend, but it did not trend up or down. We had a break in that trend in 2006 when corn began to be used in the production of ethanol. And we had the ethanol bill to roughly 2012. Since 2006 and between 2006 and 2022, corn prices have averaged $4.22. Now, corn, soybeans, and wheat prices are much higher than those long-run averages, and we have three forecasts of those prices. One is the Economic Research Service methodology used in futures prices. USDA released their long-run prices in February, and in May, so CBO released their long-run scores. If you look at corn, the 2021 price and 22 price are well above that 422 average. For example, in 2022, ERS futures methodologies forecast a 718 price, USDA 675, CBO 6. As we get out further into the future, both USDA and CBO suggest those prices are coming down. $4 for USDA forecast and below that for the CBO forecast. Both of those forecasts are suggesting that the current high prices are transitory. Same with soybeans. Soybeans has averaged 1020 between 2006 and 2020. In 2022, USDA is forecasting that price at 1440. The ERS futures price is at 1450, just a bit above the USDA forecast, and CBO is at 1250, just a little bit below. Both the USDA and CBO have those prices again, soybean prices again coming down and reaching $10, just slightly below that average price from 1020. Again, for soybeans, long-run forecasts are suggesting that our high prices are transitory and we will come back down. Same way for wheat. Average price from 2006 to 2020 was $5.62. We're well above that, above $10. Actually, $11.23 according to the ERS futures price for 2022, $10.75 for USDA for 2022. Again, those prices come back down. USDA has that coming down to $5.25 in out years. CBO has that coming down to $5.10. Again, we see that those prices are transitory. That is what projections suggest. The timing of that is actually uncertain, very uncertain. Chinese demand, which has contributed to that increase, may not come down as quickly as some expect. Ukraine-Russia war may last longer. And there are also the inflationary impacts that are out there that may cause us not to reach those long-run prices.
University of Illinois ag economist Gary Schnittke. It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
Yeah, I think most of the area has gotten at least, you know, one, at least maybe we call it a moderate shower. Although, like you indicated, we do have some areas that have gotten, you know, up to 4 to 6 inches of rain over the last, you know, couple of 3 weeks.
Sean Wade is with Plains Cotton Growers.
You know, this kind of recent round of rainfall events, you know, prior to our final plant dates has improved the situation for some growers, you know, because, you know, prior to about May the 10th, you know, it was really looking like, you know, a pretty dry situation with the forecast that we were facing. But fortunately, we've gotten a few fronts through the area, a little bit of moisture in, and we've actually gotten some rain and some showers to kick off. Now, those have come with some, you know, some hail and some other damaging weather, but fortunately, there weren't very many crops in the ground to be damaged at that point. Now the long-term forecast though is that, you know, for us to be able to, you know, kind of take advantage of, you know, whatever start we're able to get, on the heels of these rainfall events, is going to take, you know, some pretty consistent and timely rainfall through the rest of the growing season, because, even in the areas where we've gotten the most rain, those events really just haven't been able to wet the ground much more than about 10 to 12 inches deep in the best scenarios that I've heard. So definitely still a very dry forecast for this growing season without some very timely assistance. And certainly it's going to put a damper on the crop prospects as we move forward if these conditions continue.
Now, last year, it was late May before we saw the rains roll in.
Unlike last year that you alluded to, you know, last year we had a little bit of subsoil moisture, but kind of a really tight, dry kind of seed bed planting zone going into May. We were fortunate to get those late rains in May. And like you said, it did kind of put some pressure on producers to get the crop in a hurry and in a timely fashion. But they were able to do that this year with the dry conditions and you know, I guess the slightly more scattered rainfall events that we've seen. Again, like I said, they've improved the situation for a lot of growers, but really they haven't caused any delays from producers trying to get in the field. So we would fully expect all the acres to be planted in a timely fashion, and, you know, get seeded, get those acres seeded by June the 10th in our southern area. And then it's just kind of a wait and see situation to determine whether or not, you know, we've got the moisture to get that crop to germinate and emerge. And you know, in some of these northern areas and areas that have gotten more rainfall, that's kind of what we're doing already. We're looking at those planted fields and kind of trying to make determinations on, you know, what kind of a stand we're getting, how quickly is that crop emerging? Is it emerging at all? Because, you know, where we've gotten the lesser rainfall amounts, you've kind of got a unique situation. The ground is so dry that, you know, you can get an inch and a half rain, and, you know, we've got low humidity pulling that moisture away from us through the atmosphere, but also those dry soil conditions down deep are wicking that moisture down as quickly as well. So that seed bed, that seeding zone can get dry pretty quickly with just a small rainfall event. So it's still a pretty precarious situation, but I think growers are optimistic that we've gotten some rains and are hopeful that they will continue, because certainly with prices where they are today, growers would, you know, very much like to be able to get a crop established and taken all the way to harvest to take advantage of these good price situations.
It's Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
A State Department-hosted virtual roundtable Monday with public and private sector stakeholders focused on the subject of food security issues arising from Russia's invasion of Ukraine. Among the participants, Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack.
We really want to know what you know. We also want you to know what the Biden administration is doing to addressing these problems from an all-of-government approach.
The secretary noted USDA actions ranging from the full drawdown of the Bill Emerson Humanitarian Trust to provide grain to nations dependent on Ukrainian exports to continued communications with partner nations.
We're encouraging our allies and partners to come together to keep trade open, not to enact export bans, and to share best practices for sustainably increasing production to ensure that we're able to get food to those who most need it.
Discussions focused on matters such as logistical challenges and moving Ukrainian grain for export to continued contribution to the World Food Program to relieve areas of food insecurity. I'm Ron Bain reporting in Washington, D.C.